Not only did he state that, but few persons who were stockholders in the Standard Oil Company of Cleveland, Ohio, were subscribers to stock in the South Improvement Company, but he added that P.H. Watson, president of the South Improvement Company, was not a stockholder in, nor was he in any way connected with, the Standard Oil Company. As mentioned, Standard Oil executives controlled almost 50% of the SIC shares and issued 500 shares of Standard to Watson sub rosa in the January 1872 recapitalization. Although Rockefeller professed that he never lied under oath, the claim doesn't bear up under close examination. The oil wars of 1872 turned Cleveland society upside down. Many who had made easy fortunes in oil refining and built splendid mansions on Euclid Avenue found themselves bankrupt and forced to sell. Whether it was Rockefeller or the slumping oil market that forced them to sell their refineries at distress sale prices, they chose to see Rockefeller as the author of their woes. It is likely that in many cases the marketplace would eventually have closed their unprofitable firms, but Rockefeller certainly speeded up the winnowing. Though several independent refiners held on for a few years, in most cases this merely postponed the day of reckoning. Ella Grant Wilson, a social chronicler of 19th-century Cleveland, recalled how her father, a partner in the refinery of Grant, Foote & Company, had befriended Rockefeller in various Baptist causes, but refused to join Standard Oil, convinced it would fail. When it became impossible to compete with this Leviathan, his refinery went bankrupt and he surrendered his life savings. Father went almost insane over this terrible upset to his business. He walked the house night and day. He left his church and never entered a church afterward. His whole life was embittered by this experience. With so many losers in the struggle, and one shrewd, gigantic winner, it comes as no surprise to learn that John D. Rockefeller had made his first group of implacable enemies. Nowadays, most people imagine that American businessmen have always favored free competition, at least in the abstract. But in the industrial boom after the Civil War, the most significant revolt against free market capitalism came not from reformers or zealous ideologues, but from businessmen who couldn't control the maddening fluctuations in the marketplace. In an unregulated economy, they had to improvise the rules of the game as they went along. Pestered by overproduction in the early oil industry, Rockefeller tirelessly mocked those academic enthusiasts and sentimentalists who expected business to conform to their tidy competitive models. Like some of his contemporaries, he didn't see how they could build vast enduring industries in a volatile economy disrupted by recessions, deflation, and explosive boom and bust cycles, and he decided to subjugate markets instead of responding endlessly to their changing price signals. Thus, Rockefeller and other industrial captains conspired to kill competitive capitalism in favor of a new monopoly capitalism. Economic historians often cite the exuberance of Gilded Age businessmen, their red-blooded faith in America's future, without noting the constant uncertainty that lurked underneath. As Rockefeller's story shows, many of the age's most controversial business practices were forged in a desperate spirit of self-preservation. "It was forced upon us," Rockefeller said of Standard Oil's genesis. "We had to do it in self-defense. The oil business was in confusion and daily growing worse. Someone had to make a stand." Though he foresaw the triumph of cooperation, its far-ranging ramifications weren't yet clear to him. "This movement was the origin of the whole system of economic administration. It has revolutionized the way of doing business all over the world. The time was ripe for it. It had to come, though all we saw at the moment was the need to save ourselves from wasteful conditions." Then he added, as if enunciating his economic credo, "The day of combination is here to stay. Individualism has gone, never to return." Of course, companies had colluded to restrain the open play of market forces before. In Europe, guilds and state monopolies were of ancient provenance, and even Adam Smith had noted the alacrity with which businessmen hatched conspiracies against consumers. In 1872, Standard Oil was just one of many companies whose leaders had daydreams of controlling prices and production throughout their industry. When the SIC scheme surfaced, one newspaper observed, this great monopoly is one of many now forming to control the commercial products of this great nation. And it referred to the Western grain and livestock trades as analogous situations. As his own inspiration, Rockefeller cited Western Union, then busily buying up small telegraph lines, and the New York Central Railroad, which had consolidated its trunk line from the Atlantic seaboard to Chicago. During the 1870s, pools and rings flourished among salt, rope, and whiskey concerns. It was only fitting that someone with Rockefeller's personality and values should have questioned the canons of free-for-all capitalism. If the most creative and dynamic of economic systems, capitalism can also seem wasteful and inefficient to those who endure its rocky transitions and violent dislocations. By bringing forth superior methods, capitalism renders existing skills and equipment outmoded and thus fosters unceasing turmoil and change. Such a mutable system violated Rockefeller's need for stability, order, and predictability. Indeed, the sober, thrifty Puritan identified by Max Weber as the prototypical capitalist was almost certain to feel distressed by this unstable economy, which forced him to steer his orderly business through a maelstrom of incessant change. From the 3-year interview he gave privately to William O. Inglis in the late 1910s, it is clear that Rockefeller brooded for many years on a theoretical defense of monopoly. His comments are fragmentary and do not cohere into a full-blown system, yet they show that he gave the subject a great deal of intelligent thought, much more than one might have expected. He knew that he had latched on to a mighty new principle and arose as the prophet of a new dispensation in economic history. As he said, it was the battle of the new idea of cooperation against competition, and perhaps in no department of business was there a greater necessity for this cooperation than in the oil business. Rockefeller's logic deserves some scrutiny. If, as he asserted, Standard Oil was the efficient, low-cost producer in Cleveland, why didn't he just sit back and wait for competitors to go bankrupt? Why did he resort to the tremendous expense of taking over rivals and dismembering their refineries to slash capacity? According to the standard textbook models of competition, as oil prices fell below production costs, refiners should have retrenched and padlocked plants. But the oil market didn't correct itself in this manner because refiners carried heavy bank debt and other fixed costs, and they discovered that by operating at a loss they could still service some debt. Obviously, they couldn't lose money indefinitely, but as they soldiered on to postpone bankruptcy, their output dragged oil prices down to unprofitable levels for everybody. Hence, a perverse effect of the invisible hand. Each refiner, pursuing his own self-interest, generated collective misery. As Rockefeller phrased it, every man assumed to struggle hard to get all of the business, even though in so doing he brought to himself and the competitors in the business nothing but disaster. In a day of primitive accounting systems, many refiners had only the haziest notion of their profitability or lack thereof. As Rockefeller noted, oftentimes the most difficult competition comes not from the strong, the intelligent, the conservative competitor, but from the man who is holding on by the eyelids and is ignorant of his costs, and anyway he's got to keep running or bust. What made an expeditious shutdown of outmoded rivals vital to Rockefeller was that he had borrowed heavily to build gigantic plants so that he could drastically slash his unit costs. Even his first partner, Morris Clark, remembered that the volume of trade was what he always regarded as of paramount importance. Early on, Rockefeller realized that in the capital-intensive refining business, sheer size mattered greatly because it translated into economies of scale. Once, describing the foundation principle of Standard Oil, he said it was the theory of the originators that the larger the volume, the better the opportunities for the economies, and consequently the better the opportunities for giving the public a cheaper product without the dreadful competition of the late 60s ruining the business. During his career, Rockefeller cut the unit costs of refined oil almost in half, and he never deviated from this gospel of industrial efficiency. To service the outsized debt that made this possible, Rockefeller needed to smooth out the inordinate price fluctuations that made the oil business so hazardous. Realizing that the higher the economic peaks, the deeper the subsequent troughs, Rockefeller feared booms no less than busts. Neither the depressions nor the advances were profitable. The depressions gave occasion to the advances, so that the conditions of the depressions had to be offset by the advances. I concede that so far as the oil industry was concerned, we were successful in preventing to an extent these extremes so trying and unprofitable. Rockefeller preferred moderate growth purely as a matter of self-interest. His goal was to forestall potential competitors through low prices and thus minimize risk and chance disruptions. By this approach, Rockefeller believed, he could beneficently spare Standard Oil employees the plight of other industrial workers who find themselves in each period of 10 or 15 years in destitute circumstances, with bankrupt employers, owing to the foolish and universal competitive methods accompanying the excessive production of any and all products. At times, when he railed against cutthroat competition and the vagaries of the business cycle, Rockefeller sounded more like Karl Marx than our classical image of the capitalist. Like the Marxists, he believed that the competitive free-for-all eventually gave way to monopoly, and that large industrial planning units were the most sensible way to manage an economy. But while Rockefeller had faith in such private monopolies, the Marxists saw them as merely halfway houses on the road to socialism. The most tantalizing question in Rockefeller's story, and one that allows no final answer, is whether Standard Oil stimulated or retarded the oil industry's growth. Rockefeller's foremost academic supporter, Alan Nevins, believed that after the Civil War it was so cheap and easy to enter oil refining that only a monopoly could have curbed surplus capacity and brought order to the industry. Without Standard Oil, he argued, the business would have fragmented into small, antiquated units, and oil gluts, with their accompanying low prices, would have persisted indefinitely. Rockefeller believed that only a firm with the strength of Standard Oil could have attained the necessary economies of scale at that stage of the industry's development. Long after Rockefeller had exited the industrial scene, various economists, while espousing the general superiority of competition, conceded the economic wisdom of trusts under certain conditions. The conservative Austrian-born economist Joseph A. Schumpeter, for example, contended that monopolies might prove beneficial during depressions or in new rapidly shifting industries. By replacing turmoil with stability, a monopoly may make fortresses out of what otherwise might be centers of devastation, and in the end produce not only steadier but also greater expansion of total output than could be secured by an entirely uncontrolled onward rush that cannot fail to be studded with catastrophes. Schumpeter imagined that entrepreneurs wouldn't commit large sums to risky ventures if the future seemed cloudy and new competitors could easily spoil their plans. On the one hand, largest-scale plans could in many cases not materialize at all if it were not known from the outset that competition will be discouraged by heavy capital requirements or lack of experience, or that means are available to discourage or checkmate it so as to gain the time and space for further developments. As we shall see, Rockefeller keenly felt a need to freeze the industry's size, stymie new entrants, and create an island of stability in which expansion and innovation could then occur unimpeded. When Rockefeller took over competing refiners, he retained plants with up-to-date facilities and shuttered obsolete ones. It would have been impossible to shrink the industry and steady prices, however, if those who sold their outmoded plants took the money only to open new refineries. Unencumbered by antitrust laws, Rockefeller forced these refiners to sign restrictive contracts that prohibited them from sneaking back into the oil business. Rockefeller regarded these agreements, which today would be outlawed as in restraint of trade, as sacred obligations. For the most part, they were faithfully honored, though on several occasions Rockefeller hauled violators into court. For all the uproar about Rockefeller's predatory tactics, many refiners continued to defy him, and dozens of small independents survived outside of Standard Oil. Rockefeller lured many of them into his tent with an intermediate step that he called running arrangements, in which Standard Oil guaranteed them a certain level of profits if they accepted a ceiling on their output. This allowed Standard Oil to restrict the output of rivals and made Rockefeller, 100 years before the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, the chief administrator of a sweeping oil cartel. Much like OPEC leaders, Rockefeller had to arbitrate demands for increased quotas among restive members and cope with the immemorial problem of cartels, how to prevent cheaters. Whenever refiners with running arrangements exceeded their assigned allotment, Standard Oil, as the swing producer, curtailed its own output to maintain prices, exactly the dilemma faced by Saudi Arabia as the world's largest oil exporter in the 1970s. This situation steeled Rockefeller in his determination to own his competitors instead of just presiding over a confederation of perennially warring members. Where Rockefeller differed most from his fellow moguls was that he wanted to be both rich and virtuous and claimed divine sanction for his actions. Perhaps no other businessman in American history has felt so firmly on the side of the angels. Critics were quick to spy an oily sanctimony in this servant of God and mammon and wonder why his religious beliefs didn't trammel his acquisitive nature. They converted him into a wily Machiavellian or a stock figure from a Balzac novel. The pious, cunning hypocrite who showily attends church on Sunday, then spends the rest of the week trampling rivals underfoot. More generous critics argued that he simply led parallel lives with a complete separation of his public and private selves. Rockefeller himself felt no such discontinuity and always insisted that his private and commercial activities should be judged by the same exacting standards. Many years later, William O. Inglis read to him John Milton's stern denunciation of King Charles I. "For his private virtues, they are beside the question. If he oppress and extort all day, shall he be held blameless because he prayeth night and morn?" In response, Rockefeller exclaimed, "That's well put, and the oil men have got to stand the test of that." Clearly, he felt that his business conduct could withstand the most rigorous scrutiny. It is too glib to say that Rockefeller was a hypocrite who used his piety as a cloak for greed. The voice that reverberated in his ears was one of burning zeal, not low, devious cunning. He was a sincere, if highly self-serving, churchgoer, and, however deluded, extremely devout. From an early age he had learned both to use and to abuse religion, to interpret and to misinterpret Christian doctrine to suit his purposes. The church provided him with a stock of images and ideas that, instead of checking him, enabled him to proceed with a clear conscience. Religion validated his business misdeeds no less than his charitable bequests, buttressing his strongest impulses. If religion made him great, it also armed him with theological justification for his actions and may have blinded him to their brutal consequences. To reiterate an earlier point, John D. regarded God as an ally, a sort of honorary shareholder of Standard Oil who had richly blessed his fortunes. Consider this impassioned outburst he made to a reporter. "I believe the power to make money is a gift from God. Just as are the instincts for art, music, literature, the doctor's talent, the nurse's, yours, to be developed and used to the best of our ability for the good of mankind. Having been endowed with the gift I possess, I believe it is my duty to make money and still more money, and to use the money I make for the good of my fellow man according to the dictates of my conscience." For Rockefeller, there was a perfect fusion of Christianity and capitalism. And, given his extensive church involvement, it would have been odd if his career hadn't been saturated with his own version of evangelical Protestantism. Even the business of drilling and refining oil was wrapped for him in religious mystery. "The whole process seems a miracle," he once said. "What a blessing the oil has been to mankind." In pleading for his oil monopoly, Rockefeller always exhibited many qualities of the Baptist missionary. He needed to endow his aggressive business tactics with transcendent purpose and elevate his material designs into holy crusades. When faced with the squalid disorder of the oil business in the early 1870s, he converted Standard Oil, in his own mind, into the moral equivalent of the Baptist Church. His career as a trust king would be for him a Christian saga, a pilgrim's progress, where he was the exemplary man rescuing sinful refiners from their errant ways. What's most striking, both in the extensive Inglis interview and elsewhere, is that every time Rockefeller explained the rationale for Standard Oil, he resorted to patently religious imagery. The Standard was an angel of mercy reaching down from the sky and saying, "Get into the ark, put in your old junk, we'll take all the risks." He referred to Standard Oil as the Moses who delivered them, the refiners, from their folly which had wrought such havoc in their fortunes. Charged with destroying competition, Rockefeller was indignant. "I repeat again, it was not a process of destruction and waste. It was a process of upbuilding and conservation of all the interests, in our efforts most heroic, well-meant, and I would almost say reverently, godlike, to pull this broken-down industry out of the slough of despond for which we are charged with criminal proceedings." Far from being an outlaw band, Standard Oil had rendered a missionary service to the whole world. Strong as this statement is, it is the gospel truth. Further, faith and work were the rocks upon which Standard Oil was built. He credited Standard Oil with the salvation of the oil business and making it a reputable pursuit instead of a disgraceful gambling mining scheme. While he and his partners were missionaries of light and tried to treat weaker competitors with compassion, there were limits to their tolerance, since they could not stop the car of salvation in their great enterprise, which meant so much to the consuming public the world over. If his stewardship of Standard Oil exposed him to vitriolic persecution, it was exactly the martyrdom he expected. Rockefeller has often been described as a social Darwinist who viewed the harsh struggle of capitalism as a salutary process that rewarded the industrious and punished the lazy. And it is true that he adamantly opposed any government program or private charity that sapped the frontier spirit of self-reliance. Yet Rockefeller could hold contradictory views on essential matters, and his philosophic justification of cooperation rested heavily upon a direct refutation of social Darwinism. The struggle for the survival of the fittest, in the sea and on the land the world over, as well as the law of supply and demand, were observed in all the ages past until the Standard Oil Company preached the doctrines of cooperation. And it did cooperate so successfully and so fairly that its most bitter opponents were won over to its views and made to realize that rational, sane, modern, progressive administration was necessary to success. Standard Oil was thus presented as the antidote to social Darwinism, a way to bring universal brotherhood to a fractious industry. "Without Standard Oil," said Rockefeller, "there would have been the survival of the fittest, and we had proved ourselves to be the fittest, and we could have picked up the wrecks as the less fortunate brethren went down. This we did not do, but tried to call a halt and avert the impending disaster." Standard Oil would be a cooperative commonwealth, open to refiners who renounced their selfish ways to join the faithful. It would be for Rockefeller a unique case of the strong showing mercy to their weaker brethren by inviting them to participate in a common effort to save the industry. In a critical distinction, he viewed competitive capitalism, and not capitalism per se, as producing a vulgar materialism and rapacious business practices that dissolved the bonds of human brotherhood. In a state of ungoverned competition, selfish individuals tried to maximize their profits and thereby impoverished the entire industry. What the American economy needed instead were new cooperative forms, trusts, pools, monopolies, that would restrain grasping individuals for the general good. Rockefeller thus tried to reconcile trusts with Christianity, claiming that cooperation would end the egotism and materialism abhorrent to Christian values. It was an ingenious rationalization. While religion did not lead him to the concept of trusts, it did enable him to invest his vision of cooperation with a powerful moral imperative. From the outset, Standard Oil was permeated by an us-versus-them attitude that emanated from the top. At moments, Rockefeller made it sound as if he and his colleagues were a band of early Christians, misunderstood by the pagans. In this moralistic frame of mind, he was bound to see his opponents as benighted, misguided people, governed by their narrow jealousies and unwarranted prejudices, and unaware that the old gods were now obsolete. Rockefeller developed an inverted worldview, accusing his critics of exactly the same sins of which they accused him. Far from seeing himself as a rascal or bully, the Standard Oil chieftain presented himself as a respectable gentleman who attempted in vain to reason with wicked independence. In his correspondence, Rockefeller betrayed a characteristic manner of referring to his rivals. They were selfish people, forever stirring up trouble or creating annoyances, like so many mischievous children who needed a good stiff spanking from father. Never conceding any legitimacy to dissent, Rockefeller denigrated his critics as blackmailers, sharpsters, and crooks. He was now dangerously impervious to criticism. Chapter 9. The New Monarch. Fresh from the South Improvement Company brouhaha and the bruising struggle over the Cleveland refineries, Rockefeller didn't pause to catch breath. Anybody else might have consolidated his gains and proceeded cautiously, but Rockefeller, a man in a hurry, launched a new offensive instead. The SIC contretemps had stranded him in an untenable spot. Since Cleveland refiners paid the same freight rates as other refining centers, they labored under a huge competitive handicap, paying 50 cents a barrel just to ship crude oil to Cleveland before sending on the refined oil to New York. By contrast, a Titusville refiner shipped straight to the seaboard. In April 1872, Henry Flagler again extracted concessions from the Lakeshore Railroad, but not enough to appease Rockefeller. Because the Pittsburgh refiners shared a similar cost disadvantage, Rockefeller decided to make common cause with them and press the railroads for new discounts. With unmitigated cheek, Rockefeller decided that if the oil regions couldn't tolerate a small secret consortium such as the SIC, he would confront them with a giant public consortium of refiners. In mid-May 1872, scarcely more than a month after the railroads scrapped the SIC, Rockefeller and Flagler journeyed to Pittsburgh to meet with the city's three foremost refiners, William G. Worden, William Frew, and O.T. Waring. The group then went by train to Titusville, bearing a plan for the new National Refiners Association, which would be popularly dubbed the Pittsburgh Plan. This venture envisioned a new refiners cartel, headed by a central board that would negotiate advantageous terms with the railroads and maintain prices by assigning refining quotas to members. Eschewing subterfuge, the Confederation was thrown open to all refiners, but with John D. Rockefeller serving as president. Before long, Rockefeller was so detested in the oil regions that he ceased to visit and retreated to the status of a dim, shadowy legend. No authenticated photo shows him in the rural backwater to which he owed his fortune. Though the National Refiners Association theoretically embraced all comers, the Titusville refiners saw the group as the old SIC in disguise, and local newspapers admonished oilmen to beware of the slippery, smooth-talking men from Cleveland. On the Titusville streets, Rockefeller was greeted with the somber respect accorded a new monarch. As always, he presented a cordial facade that disarmed people, and in one office after another reassured wary refiners, "You misunderstand our intention. It is to save the business, not to destroy it, that we are come." At two turbulent public meetings, Flagler was hooted and jeered while Rockefeller stared impassively at the audience. One refiner left an indelible portrait of Rockefeller's aloof, cryptic manner at a private meeting. One day, several of us met at the office of one of the refiners, who I felt pretty sure was being persuaded to go into the scheme which they were talking up. Everybody talked except Mr. Rockefeller. He sat in a rocking chair, softly swinging back and forth, his hands over his face. I got pretty excited when I saw how those South Improvement men were pulling the wool over our men's eyes, and making them believe we were all going to the dogs if there wasn't an immediate combination to put up the price of refined and prevent new people coming into the business. And I made a speech which, I guess, was pretty warlike. Well, right in the middle of it, John Rockefeller stopped rocking and took down his hands and looked at me. You never saw such eyes. He took me all in, saw just how much fight he could expect from me, and I knew it. And then up went his hands, and back and forth went his chair. At a second big public meeting, the Pittsburgh plan was defeated resoundingly by local refiners, yet Rockefeller still gained ground, having enlisted influential local defectors, especially his erstwhile foe, young John D. Archbold. During the following months, in a divide-and-conquer policy, Rockefeller tried to isolate the Oil Creek refiners by successfully recruiting into his Pittsburgh plan refiners from the other major centers. But before long, this cartel was bedeviled by cheaters exceeding their quotas. It also grappled with what economists call the free rider problem, that is, opportunistic refiners stayed outside the plan and enjoyed the higher prices it produced without being bound by its production limits. As Rockefeller later said in a comparable situation, "These men who claimed that they had been crushed and ruined by the Standard Oil Company were existing under its shelter and protection." And he was besieged by problems closer to home. After Standard Oil bought decrepit old refineries in Cleveland to cut back on capacity, many sellers violated their covenants and started up new plants with improved equipment. They were drawn back, Rockefeller argued, only because he had markedly improved conditions and boosted prices. To complicate matters, new refiners now entered the business expressly to blackmail him into buying them out. In the end, frustrated by rampant cheating and freeloaders, Rockefeller gathered refiners in Saratoga Springs, New York, on June 24, 1873, and dissolved the short-lived Pittsburgh plan. He was momentarily disheartened by this failure, which again confirmed his preference for outright fusion rather than an unwieldy federation of firms. "There are some people whom the Lord Almighty cannot save," he later said wearily of the Oil Creek refiners. "They don't want to be saved. They want to go on and serve the devil and keep on in their wicked ways." In her influential polemic, Ida Tarbell evoked a paradise of free independent producers in western Pennsylvania, ruddy and joyous men, enamored of competition, who were snuffed out by the sinister Standard Oil. In her morality play, Rockefeller was the venomous toad in this garden of earthly delights. In fact, the producers didn't respond to Rockefeller by advocating freer competition, but by forming their own counter-conspiracy. In the summer of 1872, under the aegis of the Petroleum Producers Association, they approved a moratorium on new drilling to steady prices and briefly called for a complete halt to production. The producers terrorized each other, meting out nocturnal punishment to non-cooperators by setting their wells ablaze or smashing their pumping engines with sledgehammers. The producing end of the industry was populated by thousands of freebooting, high-spirited speculators who were far harder to organize than the more sober refiners, concentrated in a few urban centers, something that gave Rockefeller a decided edge. So long as he could maintain ample spreads between crude and refined prices, Rockefeller blessed the producers' efforts to impose higher prices and control output. It was a common misconception along Oil Creek, and one that fed anti-Rockefeller demonology, that he was trying to drive drillers to the wall to keep prices low. In reality, he was fully prepared to deal with a strong producers' cartel so long as they capped production. On December 19, 1872, Rockefeller met with producers at the Fifth Avenue Hotel in New York and signed the so-called Treaty of Titusville. Under this agreement, the Refiners Association pledged to buy oil from the Producers Association at $5 a barrel, nearly twice the spot market rate, in exchange for tightly enforced production limits. The agreement crumbled not because of Rockefeller, but because producers couldn't enforce discipline in their ranks. Instead of throttling the oil flow, they scrambled to pump more, with wholesale cheating driving the price as low as $2 a barrel on the crude oil market. Many small drillers outside the Producers Association took advantage of the pact to undersell their bigger competitors. This behavior ratified Rockefeller's low opinion of the producers as dissolute, unreliable men who couldn't contain a wild and uncontrollable element that would sneak out at midnight and start the pumps going so that the oil might flow before the songs of the birds were heard. With the oil industry drowning in another glut, Rockefeller terminated the agreement in January 1873, chiding the recalcitrant producers, "You have not kept your part of the contract. You have not limited the supply of oil. There is more being pumped today than ever before in the history of the region." While uncontrollable drilling was to blame, the producers found it easier to scapegoat Standard Oil. After the agreement fell apart, the disorganized producers lost all incentive to curtail production, feeding another downward spiral in oil prices. By 1873, Standard Oil was shipping about 1 million barrels of refined oil per year and earning about $1 a barrel. Yet the business remained on an unsure footing. Rockefeller had clarified one thing in his own mind, however. Voluntary associations couldn't move with the speed, unity, and efficiency he wanted. "We proved that the Producers and Refiners Associations were ropes of sand," he said. He was now through with ineffectual alliances and ready to bring the industry to heel under Standard Oil control. "The idea was mine. The idea was persisted in, too, in spite of the opposition of some who became faint-hearted at the magnitude of the undertaking, as it constantly assumed larger proportions." By early 1873, he had crossed his own Rubicon and never looked back. Once embarked on a course of action, he wasn't a man to be hobbled by doubts. In 1873, the mad dash for riches that followed the Civil War ended in a prolonged slump that ground on for 6 interminable years. On Black Thursday, September 18, 1873, the august banking house of J. Cook & Company failed because of problems in financing the Northern Pacific Railway. This event ignited a panic, leading to a stock exchange shutdown, a string of bank failures, and widespread railroad bankruptcies. During the next few years, deflated by massive unemployment, daily wages plunged 25%, exposing many Americans to the horror of downward mobility. The 6 lean years accelerated the process of consolidation that had gathered force in many economic sectors. This depression especially exacerbated the problems of the oil industry. Soon after Black Thursday, crude prices touched a shocking low of 80 cents a barrel. Within a year, prices had tumbled to 48 cents, cheaper than the cost of hauling water in some towns. Just as Carnegie expanded his steel operations after the 1873 panic, so Rockefeller saw the slump as a chance to translate his master blueprint into reality. To capitalize on rival companies selling at distress sale prices, he slashed Standard Oil's dividend to increase its cash reserves. Standard Oil weathered the 6-year depression magnificently, a fact Rockefeller attributed to its conservative financial policy and unparalleled access to bank credit and investor cash. The oil refining industry staggered under so much surplus capacity that even Standard Oil, comprising a quarter of the industry, operated only 2 of its 6 main Cleveland plants. For all that, it managed to post such creditable profits that it sometimes wooed competitors simply by giving them a privileged peek at its books. Rockefeller was acquiring unstoppable momentum, and having subdued Cleveland, he soon began his march from city to city in an unrelenting campaign of national consolidation. As his operations grew, Rockefeller made a fetish of secrecy, flavored with paranoia, a legacy of his self-conscious boyhood. One day, he saw an office employee talking to a stranger and later inquired after the man's identity. Although the subordinate said the man was a friend, Rockefeller lectured him, "Well, be very careful what you say. What does he want here? Don't let him find out anything." "But he is just a friend," the employee replied. "He doesn't want to know anything. He has just come to see me." "Quite so," said Rockefeller, "but you can never tell. Be careful, be very careful." In absorbing competitors, Rockefeller was equally secretive and asked them to continue operating under their original names and not divulge their Standard Oil ownership. They were instructed to retain their original stationery, keep secret accounts, and not allude on paper to their Cleveland connection. Internal correspondence with Standard Oil was often conducted in code or with fictitious names. Rockefeller also did this as a necessary legal expedient, for under existing law, Standard Oil of Ohio couldn't own property outside the state, a situation that invited deception by companies that operated nationally. Rockefeller warned refiners joining Standard Oil not to parade their sudden wealth, lest people wonder where they got the cash. After striking a deal with one Cleveland refiner, he invited him to his Euclid Avenue home one night and said, "But you must keep this contract secret, even from your wife. When you begin to make more money, don't let anybody know it. Don't put on any more style. You have no ambition to drive fast horses, have you?" With such thoroughgoing stealth, Standard Oil executives worried that if some newly acquired refiner died, his heirs might mistakenly claim ownership of the refinery. Rockefeller was similarly suspicious of any boasting or ostentation among associates. One day, he was riding on a train in Cleveland with Pittsburgh refiner O.T. Waring, when Waring asked him who owned a handsome dark green hillside house in the distance. "You wish to know who owns that house?" asked Rockefeller, suddenly very upset. "It's our Mr. Hopper, who makes barrels for us." "Whew! It's an expensive house, isn't it? I wonder if Hopper isn't making altogether too much money. Let's look into that." Back in the office, he pored over the accounts, decided that Hopper's profits were excessive, and terminated the contracts with him. In a similar vein, Rockefeller was concerned that if he advertised his own wealth through fancy houses, he might attract investors into the refining business and only worsen the excess capacity problem. As will be seen, Rockefeller was capable of extraordinary ferocity in compelling submission from competitors. He might starve out obdurate firms by buying all available barrels on the market or monopolize local tank cars to paralyze their operations. Yet Rockefeller didn't apply this pressure lightly and preferred patience and reason, if possible, to terror. He was not only purchasing refineries, but assembling a managerial team. The creation of Standard Oil was often less a matter of stamping out competitors than of seducing them into cooperation. In general, Rockefeller was so eager to retain original management that he accumulated expensive deadwood on the payroll, and for the sake of intra-empire harmony, preferred to be conciliatory. Several years later, one colleague wrote to him that almost the entire executive committee have made up their minds that the policy of buying out our competitors has had its day, and that to pay men salaries for doing nothing is poor business, though these men have been all their active business lives in the oil business. This policy, which kept colleagues from defecting and forming competing companies, was one of many expensive extravagances that accompanied the creation of the monopoly. With access to Oil Creek via the Allegheny River, Pittsburgh was an optimal crossroads for oil traffic, and it was inevitably targeted by Rockefeller for his second great wave of consolidation. After the failed Pittsburgh plan, Rockefeller hoped to prod, wheedle, and cajole both Pittsburgh and Philadelphia refiners into Standard Oil. During the summer of 1874, Rockefeller and Flagler attended a secret summit meeting in Saratoga Springs with their Pittsburgh and Philadelphia counterparts, Charles Lockhart and William G. Worden. By snapping up the strongest refiners in these two towns, Standard Oil hoped that it would then easily corral the smaller refiners in their wake. With its racetrack and gambling casino, Saratoga Springs was a fashionable resort for wealthy sportsmen, and, as Commodore Vanderbilt's summer home, a popular gathering spot for confidential business talks. After breakfast, the four refiners retreated to a pleasant pavilion by a spring where they talked for 6 hours. Only by banding together in one firm, Rockefeller argued in his most soothing manner, could they avert destructive price-cutting. When Lockhart and Worden hesitated, Rockefeller played his trump card. He invited Worden to come to Cleveland and inspect the Standard Oil books. When Warden later examined them, he was taken aback. Rockefeller could manufacture kerosene so inexpensively that he could sell below Warden's production costs and earn a profit. After several weeks of appraising Standard Oil and being assured of a voice in its management, Warden and Lockhart joined forces with Rockefeller. In the clandestine sale of their plants, they had the foresight to take payment in Standard Oil stock. Since Rockefeller's papers from this period are sparse, we don't know precisely why these powerful rivals yielded to him. But they were probably attracted by the access to railroad rebates, lower interest rates, scarce tank cars, and technical expertise that went along with the partnership. With this decisive stroke, Rockefeller absorbed more than half of the Pittsburgh refining capacity, with the leading Philadelphia refinery tossed in for good measure. In this way, he activated a self-sustaining movement, as his new allies agreed to consolidate business in their localities and supervise the purchase of the remaining independent refineries. A massive chain reaction was thus set in motion that rippled through both refining centers, with local businessmen now acting as Rockefeller's agents. Of 22 Pittsburgh refiners in existence when Rockefeller struck his Saratoga Springs deal, only one was still in existence independently 2 years later. Rockefeller was especially delighted to snare Charles Lockhart, a bearded Scot with a frosty, taciturn manner who was, in Rockefeller's words, one of the most experienced, self-contained, and self-controlled men in business. During the Saratoga meeting, he impressed the Standard men because he listened attentively but hardly breathed a syllable, which elicited Rockefeller's highest praise. "That's the kind of man I'd like to have go fishing with me." Though the oil business was comparatively young, Lockhart was already a veteran, having sold Seneca Oil along with William Frew in a Pittsburgh store in the 1850s. Soon after Edwin Drake's discovery, Lockhart had carried the first samples of Pennsylvania kerosene to London. Besides creating the top Pittsburgh refiner, Lockhart Frew and Company, the two men had also joined forces with William Warden to establish a Philadelphia affiliate, Warden Frew and Company, which later evolved into the Atlantic Refining Company. This innovative trio of refiners shipped oil to Liverpool aboard steamers lined with iron tanks, reducing both the risk of fire and the noisome smells. The antithesis of the penurious Lockhart, Warden was an effusive, big-hearted man with a broad face and mutton-chop whiskers. With wider-ranging interests than the average Standard Oil man, he was a former abolitionist who had donated money to black causes after the war, a conscientious Presbyterian, and an active reformer in Philadelphia politics. While stepping up his Pittsburgh and Philadelphia campaigns, Rockefeller also established a critical foothold in New York, where he had already bought the DeVoe Manufacturing Company, specialists in case oil, and the Long Island Company, operator of a large refinery. Through the efforts of Brother William, Rockefeller now took over Charles Pratt and Company. A short man with a sandy beard, Charles Pratt was a self-made Baptist with the habitual reticence that Rockefeller prized. He had manufactured paints before the Civil War, and this had led him into oil refining. With a flair for merchandising, he had made his high-quality kerosene, Astral Oil, a common fixture in American households, and so adroitly managed exports to Europe and Asia that the brand acquired international fame. In time, Charles Pratt felt slighted and pushed aside by Rockefeller, who sometimes admired his conservative style but generally mocked him as an old fogey lacking in vision. Quite unlike Warden and Lockhart, Pratt ended up on the losing side of many policy disputes with Rockefeller and took to writing him querulous letters laced with self-pity. During one squabble with Rockefeller in 1881, Pratt wrote petulantly, "I cannot see good in any effort of mine to influence you or others by any arguments." The undisclosed purchase of Charles Pratt's firm brought into the Standard fold one of the most energetic, swaggering figures in its history. Henry H. Rogers, who had led the committee of New York refiners that indignantly contested the SIC. He was now one of the first turncoats who defected to the Standard camp, and Rockefeller gloated over such conquests. I'm happy to state that in most cases the very men who were desperately opposed to anything the Standard Oil Company might suggest, when they met us face to face, when they came to know from us rather than from those maligners, they readily joined us and never had occasion to regret. Though he later clashed with Rockefeller, Rogers was a versatile executive who directed, in turn, Standard's crude oil purchases, pipelines, and manufacturing operations. As petroleum byproducts grew in importance, Rogers, with a technical grasp that exceeded Rockefeller's, patented a landmark process for separating naphtha from crude oil. No sooner had Standard Oil enlisted Charles Pratt than New York independents began to experience unaccountable shortages of vital supplies. John Ellis & Company, which manufactured petroleum jelly, suddenly found it couldn't book the requisite railroad cars for crude oil shipments. Some invisible force was working against them. As the firm tried to unravel this mystery, a Standard Oil representative took the opportunity to drop by for a friendly chat with John Ellis and warned him, "You are helpless. You will have to sell out." Appalled by this heavy-handed treatment, Ellis retorted, "I will never sell out to any company as crooked as the Standard Oil." Ellis stayed independent, but few firms had the resources or fortitude to withstand the unceasing pressure exerted by the growing legions of Standard Oil minions. In his lightning offensives in Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and New York, Rockefeller was buying refineries in strategic railroad and shipping hubs, where he could negotiate excellent transportation rates. But despite its proximity to the wells, he never considered Oil Creek an economical place for refineries, which didn't enhance his popularity in western Pennsylvania. Many ingredients used in refining, from sulfuric acid to glue to barrel hoops, cost more in that secluded area than in urban centers. By demoting the oil regions as a refining center, Rockefeller threatened the livelihood of thousands of people in Titusville, Franklin, and Oil City, and offended their sense of justice. The locals were taught to believe, in Rockefeller's words, that the place where the oil was produced gave certain rights and privileges that persons seeking to engage in other localities had no right to presume to share. Rockefeller struck them as an evil interloper, a usurper of their birthright, when he was merely exercising his right to practice business where he pleased. Nonetheless, to enforce an airtight monopoly, he needed to capture the Oil Creek refineries, if only to dismantle the least efficient ones. On January 22, 1874, he stunned local refiners by buying the Imperial Refining Company and its vast facility near Oil City. For local anti-standard firebrands, it was a move laden with ominous symbolism. One of the consenting sellers was Captain Jacob J. Vandergrift, a husky little man with a Santa Claus beard. A former skipper on the Ohio River, Vandergrift was a wealthy, God-fearing temperance advocate who commanded universal power and respect. Along Oil Creek, his desertion to Standard Oil was considered treasonous betrayal, and it demoralized local independents, precisely what Rockefeller had wanted. In early 1875, Rockefeller captured the second-largest Titusville refiner, Porter Moreland and Company, which brought 27-year-old John D. Archbold, the diminutive homilist who had electrified the crowd at the Titusville Opera House with his blazing oratory against the SIC, into the Standard Oil fold. Now, convinced that competition was a dated concept, Archbold suddenly enlisted under the banner of industrial consolidation. Aside from Henry Flagler, Archbold was the most significant figure recruited by Rockefeller. Even before he set eyes on him, Rockefeller was intrigued. Registering at a Titusville hotel one day, he noted the signature above his own name, John D. Archbold, $4 a barrel. This cocky self-promotion impressed Rockefeller, for crude oil was selling at substantially below that price. 9 years younger than Rockefeller, the boyish Archbold was a short spark plug of a man weighing about 130 pounds. The son of a Baptist circuit preacher who abandoned his family when John was 10, the prevalence of ministers' sons at Standard Oil is striking. He had come to Titusville as a teenager and grown up with the industry. Quick-witted and optimistic, a jovial raconteur, he laughed his way to a great fortune, as one contemporary said. Though not easily charmed, Rockefeller was enchanted by Archbold's high spirits, his inexhaustible fountain of jokes and stories. His short stature aside, he was the man at Standard Oil who most resembled Big Bill. Archbold became Rockefeller's proxy, picked successor, surrogate son, and court jester. Before long, Rockefeller learned that this preacher's son was overly fond of worldly pleasure and spent his nights drinking and playing poker. In time, Rockefeller forced him to repudiate alcohol, but even this only seemed to draw them closer together. When Archbold went over to Standard Oil, he was denounced bitterly as a renegade and deserter, and incurred special resentment from former admirers. He was such a deft, good-natured diplomat, however, that Rockefeller assigned him to absorb the Oil Creek refiners. In no other place did Rockefeller so sorely need an attractive substitute. Around Titusville, Standard Oil was reviled as the octopus, and Rockefeller was regarded as a monster. Mothers scolded their children by saying, "Run, children, or Rockefeller'll get you." As a result, the original Standard Oil officials never conducted buyout talks directly, but operated through acquaintances, competitors, and friends of the competitive refiners, best calculated to explain to them the situation, best fitted to succeed in the negotiations because of their intimate acquaintance, kindly relations, and the mutual confidence of neighbors and friends. Archbold was the smiling face who mollified enemies and restored peace, and with his advent, Rockefeller no longer needed to go to Oil Creek. In September 1875, Standard Oil formed the Acme Oil Company, a front organization to take over local refiners under Archbold's guidance. Within months, he had bought or leased 27 refineries, moving at such a hectic pace that he nearly drove himself to collapse. Over the next 3 or 4 years, Archbold herded the remaining independents into Standard Oil. Several letters from Archbold to Rockefeller confirm the latter's contention that he paid fairly for refiners. After grudgingly paying an exorbitant $12,000 for one refinery, Archbold told Rockefeller, "We have the feeling that it is a large price for the property, and do not doubt but that if we could hold out for a time on the present low basis, we might do better. But whether the difference is worth the ammunition is a question." Once the purchase was settled, he added, "I found it a very difficult trade to make, and was compelled to make some concessions to the parties that I disliked very much to make, regarding which I will explain to you more fully when I see you." Though independent refiners often felt squeezed by Rockefeller, he didn't always exploit their vulnerability to the maximum possible extent, and sometimes even showed leniency. At least one prominent refiner contended that he was subjected to coercion by Standard Oil when he tried to build a new refinery. Samuel Van Sickle, the pipeline pioneer, said a Standard Oil representative had offered him a good salary to abandon the project. He then said that I could make no money if I did refine oil. He also said if I did, I could not ship it. He said he would say to me confidentially that they had made such arrangements with the railroads in reference to freight, in reference to getting cars, he knew I could make no money if I did make oil. Van Sickle bowed to superior force. In May 1875, Rockefeller completed his grand design of controlling all the major refining centers when he covertly bought J.N. Camden & Company of Parkersburg, West Virginia, and rechristened it the Camden Consolidated Oil Company. Camden's correspondence documents the stealth involved in this sort of takeover. Before consummating the sale, Standard Oil requested a minute inventory of his properties and was ready to send its expert superintendent, Ambrose McGregor, to investigate. Yet Johnson Newland Camden himself, a well-known Democratic politician, feared that the superintendent of his barrel factory might recognize McGregor, and warned Standard Oil, "We would prefer having him to come here, but don't see how he could do it without exposing the whole thing. I find the superintendent of the barrel factory is a little curious about what is going on." That even a superintendent was kept in the dark about the new owners underscores the priority that Standard Oil placed on confidentiality. The Camden deal remedied a flagrant weakness for Rockefeller, who dominated refineries in the areas served by the New York Central, the Erie, and the Pennsylvania Railroads. There was only one gaping hole left in the map, the territory controlled by the Maverick Baltimore and Ohio B&O Railroad, whose tracks spanned southern Pennsylvania, connecting a cluster of refineries in Parkersburg and Wheeling, West Virginia, with an oil export center in Baltimore. Even more intolerable for Rockefeller, the upstart B&O dared to handle crude oil shipped to Pittsburgh through a pipeline called the Columbia Conduit Company, which had defied Standard Oil at every turn. In short, the B&O was providing comfort to the last independent refiners still holding out in open rebellion against his imperial rule. The president of the B&O, John W. Garrett, had long exhorted Camden to fight the Standard Goliath and offered him marked down freight rates to do so. Now that he had, unbeknownst to Garrett, defected to Rockefeller, Camden wanted to retain the rates expressly designed to shore up Standard Oil opponents. On May 12, 1875, scarcely able to suppress his mischievous glee, Camden informed his new owners in Cleveland, "Mr. Garrett is coming out to see us tomorrow. I suppose he will encourage us to keep up our oil business and fight the combination," that is, Standard Oil. And he negotiated excellent rates with Garrett. In exchange for shipping 50,000 barrels of oil monthly, he would receive a 10-cent-a-barrel drawback on all refined oil sent via the B&O, whether shipped by Camden or by his competitors. That Garrett revived the infamous drawback when he thought he was fighting Standard Oil shows that nobody could claim exclusive virtue in this business. That spring, Rockefeller gave Camden wide leeway to buy up refiners serviced by the B&O, and he quickly snatched up three Parkersburg refiners. At several points, Camden, like Archbold, bristled at the excessive prices he paid. "It almost makes me weepy to pay out good money for this kind of junk," he told Rockefeller. "But as it is a part of our duty to mankind, I suppose it is necessary to carry it through without flinching." The completion of the Baltimore campaign left John D. Rockefeller, still in his 30s, the sole master of American oil refining. Since no major crude oil deposits had been unearthed beyond western Pennsylvania, Russia perhaps being the lone exception, it also meant that he monopolized the world kerosene market. He was now living a fantasy of extravagant wealth that would have dwarfed the most febrile daydreams of William Avery Rockefeller, and few people beyond the oil business had ever even heard of him. The swift raids on the principal refining centers cost such a king's ransom that Rockefeller's most ticklish problem was how to bankroll this marathon buying spree. To entice refiners, he offered them the option of taking payment either in cash or stock, and he always dreaded the choice of cash. "I would whip out our checkbook with rather a lordly air and remark, as if it were a matter of entire indifference to us, 'Will I write a check, or would you prefer payment in Standard Oil shares?'" If they chose cash, he often had to scramble among banks to scrounge up money. By encouraging opponents to take stock, he conserved funds and also enlisted the allegiance of quondam foes in his burgeoning enterprise. But few companies followed the lead of Clark Payne and invested in Standard Oil instead of taking payment. It mortified Rockefeller that so few trusting souls took Standard Oil stock. Mostly, they doubted that Rockefeller and his young Turks could realize their experimental plan. As he recalled, "So when I offered them either spot cash outright for their property or stock in the new company, they took my money and laughed in their sleeves at my folly." Rockefeller knew, with his customary certitude, that the people who took shares would be enriched. Indeed, American high society in the 20th century would be loaded with descendants of those refiners who opted for stock. At every opportunity, Rockefeller sounded a prophetic note about the future appreciation of these shares. One Cleveland refiner who took stock later ran into Rockefeller, who asked, Do you still hold your stock? When told that was the case, Rockefeller entreated him, sell everything you've got, even to the shirt on your back, but hold on to the stock. Not all of them did, and Rockefeller always fancied that much of the venom turned against him came from disgruntled refiners who regretted having declined the stock. Despite his stupendous borrowing needs, Rockefeller no longer needed to truckle to bankers and defied the most fearsome of them all, Amasa Stone. Cold, stern, and unapproachable, Stone amassed a fortune building bridges and railroads and became managing director of the Lake Shore Railroad at the personal behest of Commodore Vanderbilt. 20 years older than Rockefeller, he expected the refiner to defer to him, and this irked the younger man. To ensure a steady flow of credit, Rockefeller put Stone on Standard's board, but when the latter grew arbitrary and domineering, Rockefeller plotted to banish him.